And why don't we begin with David? You can present your first question or comment, then Kevin will have time to respond, and then Rod again, and then continue as is natural.
Well, that was very rich and raised all sorts of powerful questions. I guess I should probably start by talking about it in relationship to what I presented yesterday, where I talked about, in part, about Luther on the following of the saints. And on one level, the Franciscan movement is a kind of case study of what Luther was against. That is to say, the formation of a group in the church based on following the external form of life of a saint. And then putting perhaps a kind of putting a value on that might contradict an improper understanding of grace. I say, and there are remarks of Luther's to that effect about the Franciscan movement, though he always, there's an edge of respect for Francis himself that never is lost there either. Having said that, and having said that maybe that's worth thinking about in terms of a critical or cautionary way of thinking, there's also something profound in Francis that doesn't capture. I mean, I certainly, that is not even, that may be, that's not anywhere close to the last word. So let me do the Luther to Francis thing that I talked about yesterday. For Luther, the imitation of Christ, the following Christ as an example, which comes after we receive him as a gift. This goes back to Augustine: Christ is sacramentum et exemplum. We must first receive him as saving mystery, and then we can follow him. But to receive Christ, to follow Christ as an example for Luther, that's the basic text for Luther is Philippians 2. It's not the external form of Christ's life, which is relative to his particular mission. We're not called to save the world. But the movement from fullness to emptiness. And Luther reads the whole of Philippians 2 as being about the incarnate Christ. He does not read it as being about the movement from the movement of the incarnation. The whole of it is Christ, the incarnate Christ, who is in the form of God, empties himself for our salvation. And that from the beginning of the end of Luther's thinking is the paradigm for the Christian life. There's a fascinating, which nobody pays any attention to because of, well, the whole issue of Luther's political thought, it's another morass. But in one of his works on, there's a kind of mirror for princes set up around Philippians 2, where the prince is thought is the ruler is instructed to think of himself, model, understand his own life as formed by that paradigm of Christ's emptying himself. Not what the average 16th century prince, not what came naturally to the average 16th century German princeling, let me tell you, but So that movement of self-emptying, of dependence on God for salvation, for grace, which then frees us to empty ourselves and be there for our neighbor, there's something in that resonates, I think, with Francis in a deep way. And so I don't see this as an opposition. I think there's a way in which Francis gives a kind of, as the Middle Ages has a tendency to do, gives kind of, as you say, kind of dramatic enactment of something, of a pattern that is fundamentally Christological, and of course, you know, you find that in the Franciscan tradition, in Bonaventure particularly. Now, Luther believed that the places where we do that, emptying, are the stände, the places where God has put us, particularly, and that's particularly the household, the polity, and the church as a community. And Luther, there's a sermon on baptism from 1519 where Luther talks about, says that in baptism, God promises you that he will destroy your sin. Talk about true joy. Promises you that he will put your sin to death. And he will undertake, and out of his great mercy, to see that there is plenty of opportunity for you to suffer and die to your sin. And that will happen in these places where he has providentially placed you. Now, I think it's a question. I know what my answer is. Does that preclude the idea of intentional communities, of people having callings to enact this same movement that is the movement of the Christian life for everyone in a particular form? I don't think it precludes it. The question wasn't posed that way to the reformers, really. So I would want to say that there's a lot that all of us, that the Reformation is not a barrier, in other words, are properly a barrier from a profound and thankful engagement with Francis.
Well, thank you. Thank you, David. I appreciate that. I'm already, can everybody, yeah, okay. I'm not a shrinking violet anyway, so. So thank you. I think that's right. I think that, one of the interesting things about Francis in contemporary theological conversation is that due to the sort of single-handed effort of John Milbank recently, he's become sort of the enemy. And one of the ways in which he's considered an enemy is because, according to Milbank, Francis sort of limited the response to the gospel to this sort of literal imitation. And that's a problem, right? And that's sort of in the spirit of what you're saying about the inner and the external. I think that, the way that bears out in the very fact that you have this radical plurality as Francis's legacy, in fact, distinctively plural and chaotic even. You know, there are other jokes about Franciscans, and banking and all that. But, the sort of chaos that follows from it, the kind of radical plurality, shows that can't be exactly right. And I do think that that in a way we have to change metaphors in terms of how we think about these things. If I think one of the great graces of the Rule of Benedict is that it gives you a handbook, right? Francis is not a handbook. He's more like a rock thrown into the pond, right? And the ripple effects are what we bear out. And every Franciscan knows that they're not quite up to it, right? And yet we benefit from the waves coming at us in this way. And so there's a kind of built-in reminder of our own failure, of our own of our own sin, really, that is kind of built in, even in as we look to Francis in that way. And that's without sort of elevating. I do think the Franciscans, at various times in history, have kind of elevated Francis to a distinctively alter Christus sort of role. That can get problematic in certain fundamental ways, and that's some of what I think Luther is explicitly responding to. But I do think that the way in which the history bears itself out bears witness to that inner self-emptying in response to this sort of radical external life.
I was really struck, Kevin, by your talking about Francis's response to poverty as gratitude. Mm-hmm. What came to mind first was what I talked about last night, the monks of Norcia saying that they've come to be thankful for having lost everything because it showed them how weak they were and how things they needed to do to get closer to Christ. But reacting to poverty as gratitude seems to me as perhaps the most countercultural thing that we could do today. Last night in the book signing, was a young woman, Nora, she may be here today from the Bruderhof, who asked me a question I couldn't answer. She said, where is the role of economics, of money, of wealth in the Benedict option? And well, as someone from the Bruderhof, you can imagine that would be a very important question. And it's one that I told her it was beyond the scope of my book. Not that it's not an important question, but it is so fundamental and so countercultural that I didn't even feel that I had the ability to even take it on in this book. And yet there it is. And listening to your remarks, Kevin, I was thinking about how our fear of poverty is really about a fear of insecurity, a fear of loss mm-hmm. of control. Mm-hmm. And we all feel that, and mm-hmm. especially when the world seems to be going out of control in ways that we haven't been used to. So I think you ended by saying that, talking about the inspiration of St. Francis's willingness to cast himself on the waves and just be a man of faith and not having control, just going where God would lead him. Can you talk a little bit about that that image in relation to liquid modernity, that concept of liquid modernity? Because I have thought that, in thinking about the Benedict option, mm-hmm. that we have no choice. We are going to be cast on the waves. And if we try to stand our ground on ground that really has eroded under us, we're going to drown, metaphorically. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we need to build arcs and just trust God. But do what we can to build arcs so we aren't swamped on the waves. But what's your thoughts?
So I think that, two thoughts. For one, I think that an arc is cast upon the wave, in a way. You know, I mean, so I don't think that these are necessarily zero-sum options in this way. And if anything, and the reminder is that, you know, whatever communities we build have no other foundation than God's grace, right? And so we shouldn't think that when we're building an ark, we're establishing a fortress, right? But the other thing I would suggest is that what the Franciscan vision, I think, is calling me to do, let me just put it personally that way, is to see that that for all of the disorientation of liquid modernity in this way, that there's a much deeper tide that is God's created world, right? That is the sort of the Spirit of God at work in the world, and that sort of by definition can't be absent. And so what Francis is asking us to do is to sort of see through the chaos of liquid modernity to a deeper tide. Right, in a sense, to respond in a kind of, in the midst of the vertiginous sort of fear that liquid modernity instills in us, and rightly so, to understand that whatever our strategic responses to that liquid modernity may be, that finally it has to be at the deepest level a movement of self-emptying trust, right, of self-dispossessive. Casting oneself onto a wave, that the wave is not modernity. The wave is God's creative and redemptive work in the world.
I guess that's what I would say.
But maybe that it to bring these together, maybe that is the right way to see liquid modernity as an opportunity for grace and self-emptying. And in this way, Francis can be a necessary corollary to the Benedict option.
Right.
And I was thinking, too, listening to you talk, that maybe this is why so many people caricature and resist even thinking about the Benedict option, because if that diagnosis is correct, then they have much less control, we have much less control than we think we do, and therefore it's frightening. But ultimately, we're going to be cast on the waves, I think, and the question is how we meet that. Will we meet it with the courage and the faith of a Francis, or will we drown?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. I found myself thinking about some old themes for me in a new way when I was when you talk about Franciscan poverty and the way in which it was a response to a culture. I remember 25 years ago teaching at a Lutheran seminary and asking myself, why is it that Lutherans can't talk to working class people? And of course, you know, Episcopalians have had a problem there too. So, so I think this is maybe something we, and I thought, well, And one day it struck me, well, you know, one thing might be that when somebody wants to be a Lutheran pastor, the first thing we do is make them go to graduate school, which means we're changing their class location. I mean, that's just automatic. Even if they come from working class roots, and I had a student who couldn't do that, a working class student who just couldn't make that shift, and he left, and he was not going to be in the ministry, you know, because so of course, living in Ambridge has given me reasons to think about that anew, and I think one of the, I mean, somebody like Francis doesn't need a sociological analysis. He acts by the instinct of the Holy Spirit. Those of us who aren't Francis probably need to think about some other things. And I think one thing that's happened in the last 50 years is that we have a class structure that's really not based on wealth. It's based on educational credentialing. A well-to-do plumber does not have status in our society. You know, he may have more money, but any recent college graduate living in mama's basement has more prestige and thinks of him or herself as the superior of a wealthy plumber. And so of course we've had I'm not making a political point here, because this is on both sides of the political divide. We've had communities like Ambridge classified as deplorable and irredeemable. We've had people on the right saying, well, communities like this, these failed working class communities, need to be disbanded. They deserve to be destroyed. So it's not just this is not a left-right thing. What does it mean to practice dependence on God and be there for the lesser in this culture? What does it mean to, you know, I want my church to start a mission here in Ambridge and be willing to fund it for about 20 years while we have time to think about how to do this, you know, because I think it might take that long for us to figure out how actually to bring the gospel to a community like Ambridge. But these are the people whose lives are in chaos, who are falling apart. What we have since the 60s become accustomed to thinking about inner city black communities is becoming the reality of the working class all over the country. And I sit in a coffee shop here on Dust Avenue and listen to conversations. I'm the last person to make that kind of connection. Aging Yale PhD, lifetime seminary professor, but I listen. I try to listen, you know. And it's astonishing, the chaos. And so, what does it mean to renounce that prestige? It has nothing to do with learning, because certainly educational credentialing in this country has very little to do with, you know, learning, knowing anything profound.
What?
So what happens if we disconnect learning from the credentialing prestige? I don't know the answer. I was thinking about another Catholic writer who thought a little bit about St. Francis, Charles Peguy, who at the beginning of the last century said that the true revolutionaries of the 20th century will be the fathers of Christian families. And that's something both evangelicals and Roman Catholics at the ground level have been discovering, not because they read Peggy usually, in the last quarter of the 20th century particularly. And I see that, and my daughter is Catholic. I'm teaching among evangelicals. I see this sense that that's another kind of countercultural calling that people are discovering within there. And not that any of these things are perfect, but there's a thing going on with the homeschool movement, and there's so many ways, you know, in which, I mean, I think all of this is about, it's not about wealth ultimately, and you indicated it's about power, and about being a creature, and there's so many ways in which that plays out analogically on every kind of level. I mean, in our culture, acknowledging that you have a human nature that you didn't make up is surrendering power in a way that's very scary to some people who've been formed by our culture. Marriage is scary, because that means you've committed yourself to another person who is going to change. You're going to change. The other person's going to change. The world is going to change. And none of that's supposed to make any difference. You're still, you're promising to be with that person. So I think that, I guess I'm rambling a bit, but all of these ways in which our culture identifies power are things we might want to ponder. So,
can I just piggyback on that by asking, why is it that Pentecostals and Charismatics succeed in talking to the poor and the working class in ways that Catholics today, mainline Protestants, and certainly Eastern Orthodox do not?
Yeah, so, I mean, that pointed question, I think, is... well, I guess my let me respond to that first and say that I think that that Pentecostals are quite comfortable talking about the imminent presence and work of the Spirit in a way that Catholics and mainline Protestants aren't. And if you're feeling disenfranchised and lost and like the world stacked up against you, you want to hear that there's something happening, not just from a distance, but something happening right now here that can speak to me, that can nourish me, that can save me. And I think that, that's something... I wrote a piece where I argued that, using some of Charles Taylor's language about social imaginaries, that Francis and his early community had a kind of, for the purpose of this writing, I called a kind of mystical social imaginary. And all I meant by that was that they just lived, they created a culture in which the expectation was that God was right there. A kind of sacramental imagination has been talked about already. That of course, the world was just waiting to show forth something of God's grace, right? And Pentecostals still sort of hold on to that expectation in a way. But let me come back then to David, your first point, I think, about mission and sort of presence. I think it's a council of patience. And one thing I didn't have a chance to talk about Francis's vision, Francis in his earlier rule, when he talks about going to evangelize the Saracen, right? And he's talking about going on. He says, you can do this in one of two ways. You can go and you can stand up on the corner in whatever city you go to and go and proclaim the gospel and you'll probably be killed. And that's a good way, right? Martin Francis himself was seeking martyrdom that way. He thought that would be a good thing. Or, he says, you can live among these people and serve them. And that's all he says. But he says that by being lesser, right, you were evangelizing them in that way. And I think that that's a counsel of patience, right? That's a counsel of patience to say the thing that's most needful in that sense is to live with, right, not live above, the community to whom you're called to minister, to whom you're called to witness. And to be lesser than them is, in a sense, already to bear witness to the gospel in that way. So, I think that kind of accompanying something that Pope Francis uses a lot now and can be misused in all sorts of various ways. But that kind of accompanying is crucial to bridging that kind of gap that you're talking about.
We talked about the famous line of Alistair MacIntyre that the world awaits a new and doubtless very different Saint Benedict. I'm curious to know your thoughts about what a new and doubtless very different Saint Francis would have to say to the 21st century, because you talked about how he and his movement emerged out of certain cultural and economic realities of the 12th century. A couple of things that strike me, and you're a historian, so help, I may be wrong here, but in that time, the church was one in the West. Mm-hmm. And you talked about the importance of ecclesial solidarity or submission to ecclesial authority. We don't have that now, not only in a post-Reformation sense, but also even among Catholics who ought to be, it ought to be clear, but they, like all other moderns, reserve the right to decide for themselves. So how would a St. Francis of today respond to that? And secondly, it strikes me as it was probably clear what orthodoxy required. This is a related question. What it required of a Christian in the 12th century, in a way that is highly contested today. So again, in those two aspects and others that come to mind, how would a what would a new and very different St. Francis be like?
Well, I think it harkens back to something you said, David, that I think that so the question, I don't know if I have an answer, but the question that one would ask is, as I said in my comments, what are the things that we use or have or hold that insulate us or protect us from that sense of casting ourselves upon the wave, right? One of them, I think, is this sense of autonomy, right? Our sense of the sovereign liberal individual self, and its capacity for self-determination in this way, and that it's scary as all get out to surrender that, right? To surrender that and to claim that there is something about me that I didn't make, and that I can't change. And don't, you know, and receive. I think that seems to be one of the pressure points for us, this sort of, and so it would mean, what would it mean? It would mean practices, great and small, of obedience, right? Now, that question of obedience gets more complicated because we don't have one one place in which to place our obedience in terms of an institution or a structure in that way. But I would suggest that what we need to do, and this we can take right out of the pages of the Franciscan texts, they used to practice obedience while they were walking down the road with each other. They would say, brother, give me a command under holy obedience to do, I mean, something silly, you know, right? And you know, you think, what is this all about? Well, but I think it's this. I mean, I think it's a practicing the skill of obeying. And talk about a countercultural practice, right? Obedience is a word we don't like. We like it for our children, right? But we don't like it for ourselves. We don't like it for our churches, right? And you know, if there's a gift that modernity can give us, it is a sense that we can see all the ways in which power can be abused and all of these things. And so we're suspicious of authority in certain ways. Okay, right? But this call to a kind of obedience, I think, that seems to me actually, I mean, the economic dimension is huge, but the submission of obedience is the key factor. And I think that you have to start with small communities of obedience, just as you've said, because we don't have an answer to a large community of obedience in that way.
We talked yesterday, I raised the question about the relationship of the new monastic movements to the church. And I just wanted to lift up a phrase from your printed text that I think is a fabulous phrase. Francis showed a consistent commitment to ecclesial belonging. Mm-hmm. And for some, in our confused authority situation, that's one way in which obedience takes form. Whatever church community you find yourself in, and you know, I think that that consistent commitment to belonging and is a kind of obedience. Yes. And a kind of renunciation of autonomy.
Yeah, that's a piece I had to cut from the text that I gave. Just but I do think that that's an important dimension of Francis's life. That's the different. You know, I said I might have time to talk about the difference between Peter Waldo and right. Is that Francis knew at a certain point that whatever else happened, he had to stay connected. And he says even like there's a passage in his testament where he said, "I knew even if I were persecuted by these priests, these leaders, I would still seek to be connected to them as a means of grace for me," right? So he's saying like, look, you can beat me up, but I'm still connected to you in this way. And that's a huge part of why Francis, I think, succeeds in that way. And that kind of ecclesial belonging is absolutely essential. It, as I said, and Rod's pointing to, it becomes complicated because we're in so many and various different situations. And what do we do if we find ourselves in a situation where we believe our leader or leaders are taking us in a direction that we don't think is true to the gospel. That's a tough one, right? What does obedience require, right? But on the other hand, how do we, why is it so important for us to be right? Right? I mean, what, you know, this is a slightly different context, but one of my models, and it was mentioned in the introductory comments by Jeff, I appreciate that. You know, I've worked on Henri de Lubac, the French Jesuit mid-century theologian. He's a role model for me, and not just a thinker I like. You may know that he was effectively silenced in the mid-20th century. And what I love about him is he said, okay. And I think he knew it was the wrong thing. Everybody knew this was really bad. And he submitted, right? And in this story, you know, it all turns out it's like the end of Job, right? It's all better at the end. In this story, like, he becomes one of the most influential people in the Second Vatican Council, right? And then the Constitution on Revelation. But, you know, so it all sort of worked its way out. But maybe it wouldn't have. And yet still, why is, you know, whatever I say, however much I may think that my own thought is important, right? Whatever I say is not worth breaking ecclesial belonging in that way. Why not submit? Why is it so important that I be, even if I'm right, why is it so important that I be right? I don't know that that's the answer every time, but it's a question we should all ask if we find ourselves in that situation of conflict.
How much time, are we out of time? That's fine. Okay. This is a question that, or an observation that maybe you and I, as non-evangelicals, aren't really prepared to answer, but it's one that I think is hugely important. When I was speaking at Southern Seminary, the Southern Baptist Seminary, about the Benedict Option, I was on Al Mohler's podcast, and he asked me at the end, do you think evangelicals have what it takes to do this? And I had to answer him, honestly, I don't know, because I don't know the evangelical world well enough to say. I said, but... To me, they need to find the resources to do it, because if we say that, oh, you have to convert to Catholicism or Eastern Orthodoxy or it's not going to work, well, then nobody's going to do that. We have to start somewhere. Mohler said to me, I'll tell you the answer, we don't have the resources to do it now, we evangelicals, but if we return to the magisterial reformation, there we will find the sources with which to do this. And that was the end of the podcast. I don't know what he meant by that, but maybe, I'm like, yeah.
A little puzzling coming from a Southern Baptist, too, but that's,
it's the mystery. We're in, right? Yeah.
No, but I do wonder, maybe we can leave it at that as an open question. Again, it's easy to talk, to hear Kevin talk about St. Francis, because they had ecclesial unity and because orthodoxy was not as contested as it is today. In some ways, his reforms and St. Benedict's reforms, they were suited to their times in that way, but we're in a much different situation. And I hope, that's one reason I'm excited by this conference, you know, that evangelicals are grappling with this question. I don't know what the ultimate answer is going to be, but I know that the Benedict option, or whatever you want to call it, the Francis option, it has to be worked out within an organic evangelical context. And if it leads some to change churches, fine, but it's not going to be the case for most people. And I'm just so excited to see the creative work of a creative minority, because all faithful Orthodox Christians, or small Orthodox Christians, are a creative minority today and are going to be increasingly so. So this work is very, very important.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. I am one who has, with many of you, left Mainline Church. And I said yesterday, you know, we have, I like to say what we've done is we cannot accept this church government that is teaching certain things, leading us in certain directions. But I think it's very important to watch ourselves and not let that become a kind of separatist mindset. As you say, where my conception of purity is so important. You've got to stop. After you can have a nice dramatic moment where you have to separate for the sake of obedience, but after that it becomes shopping, right. And we don't want to be shopping. So I think we have to somewhere you have to stick, and I think ACNA and North American Lutheran Church were founded out of hard choices and responsible choices, but now we none of us, I mean, particularly Anglicans and Lutherans, don't come from separatist traditions. And we need to recover those, be clear about those aspects of our heritage as we now try to go on. So,
thank you, panelists. We have just about 12 minutes for questions from the audience. So if you would come to this microphone here in the front, and you could ask Kevin or one of his interlocutors or any of the above.
Thanks, Kevin. That was great. First, a comment, and then a question. Among this room of Anglicans, Francis is the number one selling statue because we can't imagine having Our Lady of Guadalupe in our front yard. So the question is, in the next generation of Franciscanism, I mean, poverty became the issue, and they split over that issue. I teach undergraduates. I hear lots of things, but I could imagine an undergraduate sitting across from me saying, you know, Dr. Peters, I want to live like a Franciscan, and then he sips the $4 Frappuccino from Starbucks. Well, we could start there. This is just a practical question. If we're going to look at Francis and take that poverty seriously, I know it's not just financial, it's power. What are two or three things that you think we actually ought to be doing to appropriate Francis in that way?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And I think that, as I said, it was very hard to sort of codify what the life of poverty that Francis sort of just intuited and lived out. When it came to sort of figuring out what that meant for property rights and institutions and all that, it was a mess. And most of the solutions, legally speaking, just ran into dead ends. But there were some fruits of that argument that happened after Francis's death that I think might be useful. And we were talking about this at dinner last night, that you know, as they came up with this notion of, like, could you own anything, could you not own anything, there was a principle called the usus pauper, right? The poor use of things, right? And so Peter John O'Leary and other folks really advocated for that. It wasn't just that you had to cultivate not just a sort of whether you owned it or didn't, whether you had the certificate of ownership, you know, whether you had the title or you didn't have the title. That wherever you were doing, whether you own it or not, can you use it poorly? Can you make poor use of it? And poor use not as a qualitative statement, but like use it as necessary and no more. Right, and so, and that would be the cultivation of a kind of virtue that, in a sense, is not immediately dependent upon your income level. Right, I mean, in a sense, now I think if you lived with it and dwelt with it, it would have an effect on those things. But the desire, in a sense, to have a dramatic action that would be like, "That's it, I'm throwing it all away," and do a Francis thing, right, and strip naked. I won't do that for you, I promise. You know, can be overwhelming, but most of us are not Francis in that way. Can we just sort of think about the shape of our consumption, right? And say, what if I thought about introducing this notion of poor use into the life that I live right now, right? In a sense, to put a fine point on it, it amounts to do I need that now? Is that need or pleasure? Is that, what kind of pleasure is that? Is that going to lead, right? You know, all of these questions really are sort of contained in this question of poor use, I think. That would be a good place to start.
Do you mind if I follow up? I think that's great and that's good. Another question, or just a comment on that, would be like, so I mean, I'm gainfully employed, and with that gainful employment comes health insurance and just things, just benefits that now make me powerful. They do. I have real choices about my healthcare and things like that. So, I mean, how do you, you know, and then like even David's comment about, you know, the folks that kind of inhabit Ambridge area and things like that. I mean, how do we, what about those things where those benefits, those perks that I have, you know, how do I use those well? You know, like, well, I know we could go have that checked out, son, but why don't you cough a few more days and see if it goes away on its own? You know,
right. Well, I mean, on that issue in particular, notice how Francis is always willing to make an exception for health, right? No matter how, even his strictest prohibitions against touching money, against these sorts of things, if somebody's really sick, you just need to do what you need to do in that way. And so I think that that could be a principle in this way. But I mean, but there are other sort of radical alternatives that people put forward, like, you know, like Simple Way. They're all part of this sort of cost sharing, medical cost sharing account, right? You know, that's a radical rejection of the system of insurance as we have it, and substituting in a sort of shared community reliance in that way, where we share each other's burdens more directly. You know, that's a radical solution. Some of us, you know, that's harder for me with three daughters. So I'm not sure I'm up for that kind of choice. But I could still think about poor use. Not, now, poor use would never be, you know, keep coughing. But poor use would be like, well, elective surgery for that, or, you know, I mean, just, you know, these sorts of things that are easy for us to say yes to. And the question then becomes, is that covered, right? Rather than, is that necessary, right? Something like that.
Are you saying it's a mortal sin for me to get a tummy tuck?
I make no comment on your tummy, Rob.
You know, in the background of this is the whole question of the Sermon on the Mount.
Exactly.
And it's a puzzling text, and I remember C.S. Lewis saying that he couldn't understand people who thought the Sermon on the Mount was beautiful. So I guess you could think getting hit in the face with a hammer was beautiful, but I think the sermon is clearly meant to be a rule of life for a real community. It's not an impossible ideal, the Niebuhr thing, which Luther gets blamed for, but it's actually Reinhold Niebuhr.
So many things.
But on the other hand, if you try to take it as a code, you run into problems pretty quickly. I mean, judge not lest so that you are not judged, and then not very far along you read, don't cast your pearls before swine. Well, how do you determine who the swine are without judging? You know, I mean, there's clearly an
issue
here. Well,
sometimes it's just obvious.
Yeah, well, that's true.
You don't need to judge.
You said you weren't going to talk about it.
So I think there's a kind of mystery about that text. That we live with it and we never quite know what to do with it.
Yeah. So. I think, too, in terms of the poverty of right use, mm-hmm. I think this is where the traditional practices of the church for fasting seasons and feasting seasons is helpful, because I've seen in some cases people talk about poverty and use it to justify hating beauty. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that this is something fancy, we don't need that. Well, sometimes we do need that. And sometimes we are meant to cherish these good gifts of God, things that are strike us as fancy. But if that becomes a way of life, that is wrong use too. In the same way, I think refusing the graces that come to us in beauty or good food or beautiful music, that sort of thing, is also a kind of poverty, but maybe even a more self-righteous kind of poverty, because I don't need that fancy stuff.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But yeah, if you do the fasting and feasting, it keeps it in right balance, I think.
Yeah, there's a great story about Dorothy Day. Some people may know, like, some of her Catholic worker peers were in an uproar about the building of the new cathedral in San Francisco. You know, this is ridiculous use of wealth, and how are we doing this, or whatever. And she went and she sat in the cathedral for a while and said, look, this is a space that's used by the poor, and the poor deserve beauty too. You know, and her Catholic worker colleagues were like, come on, Dorothy's going to be with us. And she was not, you know. She said, no, this is right use, actually, in this case, right? That beauty is a gift that ought to be given in these big public spaces in this way. You know, and then that's a way that she said, that was a gift to us all and to the poor, rather than taking away from them.
Well, and this was a lesson of Babette's Feast, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Film, you know.
Yeah.
Very Franciscan of you too. So my question is really, it's very meta to the point that it might be vague, but it's what I'm thinking about, so I'm just going to sort of throw it out and see what you guys do with it. But I love St. Francis. I was really, really obsessed with him in college. And so I've read and thought about Francis and his notion that money is sort of the thing that our culture can use to insulate ourselves from our dependence. I think it's still right on in our culture. That this is, I'm just, I don't know if that's fine if you don't think that's true. But I think there's still something to that. But it just seems like it's grown so much that that consumerism now is not simply having a lot of money or being materialistic, but it's this superstructure that we're born into. We are primarily identified as consumers to the extent that I would say in America, even among the poor, you find consumerism. And certainly among the wealthy, you find consumerism. And you find this really sophisticated consumerism that rejects consumerism, like Tom's shoes, where you can like feel virtuous and be a consumer at the same time.
Like the very expertly produced Simple Living magazine. You know,
right.
That costs $10 an issue, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. I'm wrestling, like, so one of the things that I've wrestled with the Binop that I've talked to Rod about some is that it's the problem with consumerism, it seems to me, is that it just gobbles everything up. There's just nothing that it can't consume. And so something like wanting, even you see this with fundamentalism, where I feel like it can just really become a separate consumer culture, a subculture, where you're just getting sort of different things that you're consuming. And the simple way, I was part of, not the simple way, but that whole sort of 90s Christian movement, and I love it, lots of it, but there certainly are, I mean, you go to conferences and everyone's kind of wearing the same clothes and have the same dreadlocks, and it's sort of, it's a subculture. So I guess what I'm saying is, I was talking to a friend who works at University of Virginia, and he said, when he read the Binop, he recommended a book and said, this is like the true Binop. And it's a book, I can't recall the title, it's out right now, about people that are living entirely without money. Does anyone remember this book? But anyway, they're living off the grid, and their whole life project is to like radically escape the structures of consumerism. So I guess what I'm asking, because I'm a pastor, and I'm not going to go tell everyone on Sunday that they have to radically escape all the structures of consumerism. But maybe I should. And so I guess what I'm wrestling with is, in your mind, when this sort of power and principality and structures, like it's really hard to escape it, how do we live in such a way that's truly alternative, where the Binop or any kind of other movement doesn't just become a subculture of consumerism? Like, how do we reject that core of a notion that it's culture shaping? Or is that just impossible at the end of the day, that there are just some waters we swim in we can't escape?
That's an excellent question, and in a way, it's the question. I don't think it's impossible, but I think it's perpetual. In other words, there's a constant temptation to think, well, we've made this choice, and now let's build our culture, right? You know, whether it's the Benedict option or whatever, and here we go, and what resources are we going to draw on to build that culture? Well, they end up being the strategies of consumption, right? You know, and as you say, it really is, the beast from the sea that can just sort of swallow and co-opt everything in this way. So it means a perpetual small acts of resistance, I guess is what I would say. We need somebody like Francis who can sort of shatter things to wake us up to how pervasive it is and what it would look like to live a radical alternative. But like I said, there were lots of people who were not able to live like Francis did and yet still considered themselves to be followers of Francis. And I think that the same is true for us today. It's not a great solution. I wish it were a perfect solution, but all we have, I think, in a sense, is strategic decisions here and here and here and here. Maybe, I mean, if we wanted to use this term, tactical decisions here and here and here and here and here, to say, yeah, not that. Not that. And it requires a kind of a vigilance, I think, that most of us would rather not do. But I will say, the last thing I'll say about it is that you can look at the history of spiritualities, the history of religious movements, the history of orders. You look at the Franciscans, one of the reasons why there's so many of them right? So many Franciscan communities is because they're constantly saying, wait, we've lost our way. Let's refound ourselves here.
And the Benedictines too.
Absolutely, right? And so there's this constant calling back to the source to say, wait, we're going astray here. Let's try again. And so the Capuchin movement is a reform movement saying, let's get back to what Francis taught. And then they'll end up being co-opted in certain ways too. I mean, I don't think I said this in my talk. I thought I was going to say it, and I didn't end up saying it. Is that one of the things that happened in the 12th and 13th century is that the Benedictines and the Cistercians, who had been the sort of radical reform movement, had been kind of co-opted into the systems of society in this way, and so they needed to be pushed back against, you know, and that's a perpetual thing until the kingdom. I think, you know, that kind of micro strategies of resistance are all we have.
And what your friend at UVA is asking, basically, or saying is, yes, we do need to head for the hills and build a compound. I mean, just in a different way. And I could admire people who feel that the calling to be that radical. But like Kevin, I don't believe that that is the calling for most of us, that it is our calling or that it's even feasible. You know, and so I think in a way, construing things as that radical either or is a council of despair for a lot of people, because we are embedded in these worlds. We have responsibilities to our families, to our children, to our neighbors, and so forth. It could even be sinful to sever those roots to go hide out in the mountains, metaphorically. So I don't know. I don't think there is such a clear-cut answer. I think that the pluralism that Kevin was talking about earlier, I think that's the only really workable and sane solution, is to try to learn from each other and not be so quick to judge the other, but to help build each other up.
I think one thing to ask is, what is really the project to which we're called? Is it to escape consumerism, or is it to love God and our neighbor? And loving God and our neighbor will mean resisting lots of stuff, most of it in here, not out there. And there's no way to do it but piecemeal. Even the idea that I know what's wrong with the world, it's consumerism, and now I'm going to plan, you know, to escape it, is a way of exercising power, of being in control. The fact is, I'm a human atom that was cast into this world and have got where I am now, very little of it by having a plan. And along the way, I've accumulated obligations. I've accumulated ties. And at every moment, I have to think about that kenosis. You know, I have to think about what it means to love God and my neighbor, trust God, I'm also not in control of my salvation. I have to trust God for that too. There is a sermon by John Henry Newman called "The World, Our Enemy," in the parochial and plain sermons, and he talks about how the church. It's a great sermon. He talks about how the church is a body gathered together in the world and in a process of separation from it. But the world's power, alas, is over the church, because the church has gone forth into the world to save the world. And he goes on to say, we are, in effect, the world to one another, even in the church. He ends up by talking about the impossibility of dealing with this in any sweeping way. He says, let us, avoiding all refinements which lead to a display of words only, not to the improvement of our hearts and conduct, let us set to work practically. Instead of attempting to judge of mankind on a large scale and to settle deep questions, let us take what is close at hand and concerns ourselves, and make use of such knowledge as we can obtain. Look not about for the world as some vast and gigantic evil far off. Its temptations are close to you, apt and ready, suddenly offered and subtle in their address. Try to bring down the words of Scripture to common life and to recognize the evil in which this world lies in your own hearts. That's That's the last word I have to say about the church and the world in my theological teaching. So.
Well, thank you, panelists. I'm sorry we don't have time for more questions, but and thank you especially, Dr. Hughes.
The Ancient Evangelical Future Conference is hosted annually by the Robert E. Weber Center at Trinity School for Ministry. This recording is a production of Whitchurch Publishing, trusted resources from Trinity School for Ministry, all rights reserved. Visit us on the web at www.tsm.edu.